Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It was Friedrich von Schelling, or it was Goethe. There's a great argument about this, who got off the great line, Das Baukunst ist eine erstarrte Musik. Architecture, or the art of building, is frozen music. That's quoted all the time. Does it make any sense at all? I ask of Blair Kamen and John Ronan, after I quickly reintroduce them. Blair Kamen, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune. John Ronan is the lead man at his own firm, John Ronan Architects, and has done a number of interesting buildings recently, of which we shall shortly talk. What does it mean, architecture is frozen music?
Well, it means that buildings with steel and glass and stone can summon emotions and inspire us in a way that music can, except that they don't move, whereas music does. Music goes away, though. Buildings don't, for better and for worse.
Architecture, I've often said, and you've heard me argue this, is the ultimate public art, and you're stuck with it.
That's right.
When they put up a building, if you don't like it, you're going to have to look at it for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I think it's also a distinction between architecture and building, too, that he was getting at, right? There's prose, and then there's poetry, and then there's sound, and then there's music. So I think he was talking about the best architecture that we have to offer.
Are there buildings, John, on the skyline of Chicago that give you a chill or give you a momentary flashing sense of depression whenever you see them?
Yes, I think there's several buildings in town that can elicit certain emotions certain times of day under certain light
conditions. What are some of the buildings you love to hate?
Well, that I love to hate.
Or that you hate.
That I hate.
One
I hate
way
the Doral Plaza. Michigan, the Doral Plaza.
Right there on Michigan.
Which doesn't look good in any light.
You know.
I'll let Blair do the next one, and then I can trade off.
The Sun-Times building. I mean, not to pick on the Sun-Times, but it's a Hulk, right? Right, the Holiday Inn Merchandise Mart Plaza, whatever that thing is called.
Wait, when you say the Sun-Times building, you mean the present Sun-Times building?
The present Sun-Times
building. Not the one they tore down.
No, although that was no prize winner either.
Yeah.
But this is the hulking high-rise of concrete just west of the Merchandise Mart.
It was originally built for what?
I think it was the Merchandise Mart. It was an annex to the Merchandise Mart, and then there was a hotel on top of it. It's really ugly.
Yeah, it was the apparel center.
That's right.
That leads almost instantly to a very to an important question. What about the building that has risen where the Sun-Times once stood? Do we call it Trump Tower or Trump what?
Trump International Hotel and
Trump
Tower.
Trump International. What do you think of it?
Better than expected from Donald Trump. Not up to the standard of the John Hancock Center, which I think is Chicago's greatest skyscraper, but with some faults, a pretty crummy spire and kind of bulky from certain vantage points, but very delightful from others. The building has a beautiful curtain wall. It changes in the late afternoon light, especially from blue to almost white, and it's lovely. Who would have ever thought we'd get that from Donald Trump?
Well, he didn't do the design, though. Didn't we have the man who did the design on this
Skidmore,
program?
Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and Adrian Smith was the lead designer.
And we had him with you on the program.
He's been here, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it a very handsome building as sculpture. I've not yet ever been in it.
Yeah. I think it's on a very unique site in Chicago. That site looks right down south, down Wabash. And I think it takes advantage of some of those sight lines, but I think it could have been more successful in the way it treats its very important neighbor, the IBM building. The IBM building used to have these beautiful views down the Chicago River, which Trump pretty much negated. And I think it could have been a little more sensitive in that regard.
I gather, indeed you told me before we came on the air tonight, that there stand more or less downtown at least three incomplete buildings, which apparently are going to remain as frames for some time to come, which is a kind of an eyesore, surely. Why aren't they going up? We'll talk about those three halfway constructed edifices when we return, right after we pause, for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And I was struggling for a way of describing all of these half-completed buildings standing there. And during the break just now, Blair gave me the proper designation. You call them?
The Incredible Hulks.
The Incredible Hulks. There are three downtown.
There are three. And the one, of course, that's most prominent that everyone talks about is the hole, which really isn't a Hulk. It's just a hole in the ground for the at 400 North Lakeshore Drive for what was to be the Chicago Spire, the 2,000-foot tall twisting tower.
To be the tallest building by far in all the world.
Not in the world, but in North America. There's
designed by this Spanish fellow.
Santiago Calatrava.
Yeah.
Right.
What's happened?
Zip. It died a couple of years ago. It's been sitting there. The developer, Garrett Kelleher from Ireland, is nowhere to be seen. Rumor has it that he's back in Ireland, laying low. Everybody's suing him. They want their money. So that's Incredible Hulk number one.
That's 400?
400 North Lakeshore Drive.
North Lakeshore Drive.
Right.
It's just a big empty lot still.
Big, huge empty lot.
Will it remain so for?
For a while.
Yeah,
something will eventually get built there. It's a great, site.
Why did it fail? Was it a good idea to plan that building? Did you like the design?
No, it wasn't a good idea, really. I mean, it was kind of at the tail end of this kind of very bombastic period where everything was just getting bigger and bigger, and it was really the wrong site, I think, to do a building that tall. It's very hard to get to that site. Very awkward. And, I think it was probably very easy to rent out or to sell the top units. But, I don't think they could ever get enough momentum to keep that thing going.
I didn't see the details of the design, but I remember some of the simple representations of the total building. And it looked so thin on top that you couldn't quite imagine getting a grand piano into a room.
It looked like a big drill bit, basically, the form of it. And
what use was supposed to be made of it, if it ever had actually risen?
It was.
It wasn't all residential.
Yeah, pretty much.
It was 1,000 condos in its final form. Yeah,
1,000 condos.
Yeah, and it just never got off the ground. There was, they had sold some of the units. The Beanie Babies guy, Ty Warner, supposedly bought the penthouse. But I hope he's gotten his deposit back. I mean, God knows what
the penthouse would have been very constricted, as I
It still would have been a few thousand square feet. Yeah. About close to 2,000 feet up. It would have been a pretty good pretty good view. I think it's fair.
Would have been fun to wave in the wind every night.
Yeah,
during the winter.
This is true. Anyway, so that's Incredible Hulk number one. Now, Incredible Hulk number two is at Clark and Wacker. That was to be the 90-story tall Waterview tower and a condo tower and a Mandarin Oriental Hotel. And that stopped construction in 2008. It's been sitting there for 3 years. It's a 26-story Hulk.
Now, what's gone wrong there? Why did it stop?
Same problem, essentially. The credit crunch hit. No one was lending it money. Banks weren't lending money at that point. And it probably was grandiose, overblown. And just couldn't make a go of it financially, so it stopped.
I think the hotel pulled out too. That's what killed a lot of the projects, not just in Chicago but across the country. The hotel was really required to make those projects go because they sold a lot of the units on the premise that you would be able to use the hotel amenities. Or your guests could stay at the hotel. So you could really buy a smaller apartment and have your guests stay at the hotel. So when the hotel pulls out, it really becomes problematic for the whole development.
How then did Trump manage to get his tower up? It's hotel, it's residential, it's commercial. And as I understand it, he is kind of a Luftmensch. He lives on borrowed money, and he's not himself a true billionaire. Is that right?
I think there's one word that explains that, or maybe say three words. Yeah. One is celebrity. The other two words are The Apprentice. Trump, whatever you think of him, is a brilliant marketer. He's the P.T. Barnum of our time. He parlayed all the publicity that he got from The Apprentice and used it to sell enough units early on in the boom years to convince the banks that he was going to make this project go. And that's how he got it built. His timing was almost just right. And I say almost just right because he got it done, whereas the Spire did not happen and Waterview did not happen. But he still hasn't sold enough units yet to make money. he's still underwater.
Oh, it's an empty building, is it?
No, it's not empty, but it's only about two-thirds, maybe 70% full. So he, Adrian Smith, the architect, has said that he needed to sell roughly 80% or so of the units to get in the black. And I don't think he's in the black yet.
Interesting. And Empty Space number three? Or Incredible Hulk number three?
Incredible Hulk number three. A little less high profile is the Staybridge Suites, which is a hotel designed by Joe Valerio, Chicago architect, in River North. What's the cross street, John?
LaSalle and Erie, maybe.
Right, so. Right. And that's been sitting there, you know.
Years. It looks like a Cristo project. It's just kind of, really? They wrapped it in tarp and they walked
LaSalle
away.
LaSalle and Erie.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're heading to the Erie Cafe, which is across LaSalle, you would pass it.
Well, yeah, Erie Cafe is at the kind of the river in Erie. This would be, you know, by the BP station on Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually quite beautiful at night. It's lit up from inside and kind of glows at night. So maybe it has a future as an art project.
Some empty structures are nicer than completed structures.
Well, they say that.
But Milt, to put things in perspective, when I was in Dubai a year and a half ago, I walked through an entire subdivision, an entire district of half-finished buildings, 20 buildings. And, you know, Chicago has three. We all moan about them and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, Chicago's problem in this is comparatively tiny compared to other cities around the world.
For a long time, another quasi-empty space in Chicago was a whole block, the one known as Block 37.
Correct.
It's now got something on it, and it now is functioning as what?
Oh, geez, it's kind of a mixed-use retail mall. Blair would know better what's in there. I haven't dared to go inside yet.
So. Yeah, well,
Is there one big building or a complex of buildings?
It's two buildings, actually. There's about a roughly 20-story office building designed by Ralph Johnson, a very good architect. Mm-hmm. And this isn't one of his better buildings, unfortunately, that faces Daley Plaza. And then there's the retail mall, which is bounded by Randolph State, Washington, and I can't remember the other street. But in any event, it's maybe half full at best. Retail is in terrible shape these days, so it's mostly empty. There's not a lot of action there. There was supposed to be a CTA superstation there that would take you on the blue line out to O'Hare, whisk you out there. That never got finished. So the project is, fair to say, both aesthetically and economically a disappointment.
And this is not a temporary structure waiting for...
This is there. They want to build high-rises on top of this structure. There are plans for a condo tower, good luck, in the current market, and a hotel tower to come later on. But that's, you know, way off in the future.
So our conversation so far has really been reflecting on what the recession did to building in Chicago.
You bet. And the recession whacked Chicago pretty hard. There are lots of architects, unlike John, who are, you know, out of work.
But John makes good money.
And ask John.
We won't ask him how much money he makes, but he does good buildings, apparently.
He does very good buildings.
And one of the main things worth talking about, because it's a new building in Chicago, opened officially only a month ago or so, is the building for the Poetry Foundation.
The Poetry Foundation building. And
where is it? What does it look like?
Well, should we ask John?
Why don't we?
Okay. It's at Dearborn and Superior, and it's a two-story building. It appears from the street as kind of a black sort of minimalist object. As you get closer, the metal that it's clad with becomes perforated, and you can see into a garden, and it sort of draws you inside. And so the idea of this building was to be against some of the architecture that we see today that is very highly photogenic or meant to be kind of consumed in one glance. This was a little bit different. We were trying to do a building that would draw you into it in a kind of a slowly unfolding spatial sequence, a building that you really wouldn't understand until you walked all the way through, kind of unfolding, almost like a poem unfolds line by line.
So you're looking for the architectural correlative of a poem.
Yeah, in a way. A poetic building.
Uh-huh.
So not inscribing the building with poetry, but thinking how architecture can be like poetry. So I'm going back to your kind of quote, your Goethe quote. That was a conscious, you know, how do we do a building that speaks to poetry? Because there was there's no paradigm for a building of this kind. There aren't other buildings for poetry. So unlike doing a house for a school, this is a really a unique challenge.
There's a great story behind the ultimate funding and then the design and then the erection of this building. Those folks at Poetry Magazine, since 1910 or thereabouts, when it was first founded?
1912.
Mm-hmm. Lived on a very, very slight budget. Mm-hmm. And one day a woman who had been contributing poems to the magazine for years, and her poems had always been rejected.
That's
correct. She had never had a poem published in Poetry Magazine, mm-hmm. But she died, and her will specified that $100 million of her fortune was to go to the Poetry Foundation.
Yeah. She actually gave $100 million before she died as a gift.
Oh, is that so?
To the Poetry Magazine, and that's the money that started the foundation. Yeah.
And
so the lesson there is to be really be really kind to your be kind to your contributors and supporters.
They must have written her some really nice rejection letters.
I think they did. I think they were very encouraging.
Yeah.
To her, you know.
She has passed on.
She died, I believe, this past year. Yeah.
And now somehow the bequest has grown to about $200 million, I read recently.
Yes, I don't know the specifics of it, but I know they got another sum of money after, as part of her will and her bequest, yeah.
And so they decided to put up a building.
Yeah.
As well they should.
Yeah.
And that cost a mere 10 or 20 million, I would suppose.
Yeah, the building was about 10 million, and the overall project, including the land and all soft costs and so forth, was 21 million.
You know, I haven't been into it. Indeed, I think I only passed it once in the car. I must get down there quickly. Mm-hmm. Is there, by the way, a good lunch available?
Well, you can't eat in the building.
You cannot.
There's no cafe, but they have many programs throughout the the month. A lot of exciting kind of poets coming in. One of the main spaces is a performance space where poets will come and read their work to an audience against the backdrop of this garden. But the building is open to the public on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and there's a library, a gallery, and mm-hmm. You can see the performance space as well.
We are about to pause. We're overdue for an update on the news. And then we'll go back to the skyline and look at some things worth celebrating and some things worth moaning over. We might talk not only about what's going on downtown Chicago, but around town and surely heading south towards the University of Chicago, where some interesting things have been happening. And all of that will continue right after the update on the news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Rob Martyr.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we return to Blair Kamen and John Ronan as we are talking about some of the main buildings going up recently, that have gone up recently around Chicago. And we were talking about the Poetry Foundation building. Let's talk a little bit more about our resident architect who's sitting with us right now. And I'll ask you, Blair, to tell us really the significance of John Ronan. We'll see whether he agrees.
Well, John's one of the architects, young architects in Chicago, who have reinvigorated the architectural scene here. One of his most significant buildings before the Poetry Foundation was called the Gary Comer Youth Center. And this is in the Grand Crossing neighborhood of Chicago, which is a tough urban neighborhood. Gary Comer, the patron of the building, donated a lot of money for a home for the South Shore Drill Team, which is a real iconic presence down there.
Is this a Comer who made his fortune at Land's End?
Yes,
exactly.
And has also funded a brand new children's hospital at the University of Chicago.
Actually, correct. Twice, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Gary Comer grew up in Grand Crossing and never forgot where he came from, which mm-hmm. is really to his great credit. So John shaped a building down there, the Gary Comer Youth Center, which is a real beacon of optimism for the neighborhood. It has a home for the South Shore Drill Team where they can march around inside and practice. It consists of a series of interlock spaces, including a gym that can convert into a theater, mm-hmm. right? And it has a rooftop garden, and it has classrooms that surround this inner area. And it was designed under tough circumstances because some of the windows had to be bulletproof, mm-hmm. correct, because of the threat of urban violence in the neighborhood. But it is not a fortress. It's full of light, hope, optimism. and it won a National Design Award from the American Institute of Architects, a pretty high honor that many architects in Chicago have never won. So that's really the building that put John on the map. And it's and I think even then he was doing buildings that were not, as he says, easily consumable. He was after spatial complexity, not formal complexity. Formal complexity in the sense of doing something that was, you know, a wow eye-inducing, a wow-inducing eye-catching shape.
You're based, and your firm is based in Chicago, but you've been building elsewhere around the country and around portions of the world, I gather.
Yeah, that's correct. We've worked all over the country and internationally as well.
Mm-hmm. What was your most ambitious project?
The most ambitious one, probably the Youth Center. Mm-hmm. I think because, again, before poetry, let's say, because like poetry, it was there was really there wasn't a model for that project. It was kind of it was a youth center, but it was also an education center, just a strange mix of all these different programs. And Gary Comer, who was the client, would call me weekly at the office and change the program. He'd say, you know, I want to get a job training center in here. I want to have a nurse's training classroom the next week. It would be a recording studio. And just kind of the program was just changing very rapidly. So it was quite a challenge. But Gary wanted to get it built and built quickly. So the design really reflects the ability to maybe change the building out over time.
As we're talking about John, let's broaden this, and I'll ask you to do this, Blair. Tell me what school, if any, he represents, and what are the trends as architectural design is unfolding these days?
Well, John's a modernist. He's
and
not.
What does that mean, actually?
Well, that means that he
doesn't mean he's in the tradition of Van der Rohe.
I think his work is informed by Mies van der Rohe's work, but it reflects sensitivity to his urban surroundings and his users that Mies's work didn't necessarily have. What I think happened was that, you know, you had all these steel and glass boxes going up in the 60s.
That's the so-called international style.
The international style of architecture, of which Mies was the prime exponent.
Yeah.
There was a reaction against that in Chicago, and it was led by a group called the Chicago Seven, which was itself led by Stanley Tigerman, Ben Weiss, Stuart Cohen, some other notable architects, Larry Booth. And they said, look, there's more to our tradition in Chicago than great commercial buildings. We need to be able to look back to look at all of our history, the great Art Deco buildings like the Chicago Board of Trade, or buildings by, you know, many other architects that were overlooked by the so-called Chicago School of Architecture. So I think the new modernists like John and others have learned some of the lessons of postmodernism, but without the kind of cutesy, gimmicky stuff that goes on in postmodernism.
Are there these days, not merely in Chicago, but looking at the architectural scene broadly, mm-hmm. say in the Western world or all the world, mm-hmm. Are there competing schools? Are there other traditions or other competing visions which are also being served?
Yeah, I would say there's kind of three major trends going on right now in architecture.
It's great when it comes in threes. What are they?
Well, there's the new emerging technologies, and these are both the kind of technologies that architects use to design the building, but also technologies that are used to fabricate the components of buildings mm-hmm. and how buildings are built. So architects are kind of getting their arms around these new technologies and trying to figure out what its role is within architecture. Sustainability is another one that the entire world has kind of gravitated to out of necessity, and architects have really embraced sustainability. This has been a bit of a double-edged sword, I think. And the last one is really the kind of the merging of architecture and landscape, or put a different way, the building and the ground, this kind of blurring of distinctions. So in Mies's day, you know, it was very clear what was the building and what was the ground. Now it's we're kind of blurring those distinctions, and it's not so clear always where the landscape ends and the building begins. And that's a really exciting trend, I think.
I don't know what the school was called, but for a while lots of people were practicing it. I can give you one building that really represents it that everybody knows and which I despise. I love to hate certain kinds of buildings. And there are two or three around high on the skyline of Chicago that I really do dislike. And this one is, I guess, commonly called these days the Bloomingdale's building. Right down Michigan Avenue,
right.
Whatever the exact address
right.
is.
Right, 900 North Michigan.
900 North Michigan.
Right, by Cohn Patterson Fox of New York.
Whoever they are. And it would have been all right and just unexceptional, except for those four Disney towers they put on top of it, which seemed to me just a joke or a vulgarity. And you see them all the time when you're driving in from the airport, say, because there it is looming up on the skyline. Now, what do you call, what kind of architectural tradition informed or generated
well, that's
that
a
particular building?
Okay, that's a postmodern building, clearly.
It's called postmodernism.
A building that borrows heavily from history. A building, postmodern buildings, many of them tend to be faced, many of the skyscrapers tend to be faced in stone or a veneer of stone attached to a steel frame. And that building was informed in many respects by the Waldorf Astoria Tower in New York. It drew from that tradition.
Really?
I don't think it draws particularly successfully from that tradition. I think of those little little hats on the top, little towers on the top as little Hershey's Kisses up on,
or something.
Up on the skyline. Yeah, they look a little too diminutive.
The only top that's worse, that's worse than that in Chicago, you know the one I'm about to name here.
Yep, I know. You're going to talk about 311 South Wacker Drive.
Exactly.
Yes.
Where you've got that water tower on top
yes.
or whatever.
Another Cohn Patterson Fox building.
Same people.
No. Now, Milt, these guys also, we got to give them credit. They did 333 West
Wacker. That's
what
Wacker, you always say.
Which is wonderful. But yes, the 311, it is a poke in the eye, as the AIA guide to Chicago calls it.
Yeah.
So yes, that is rather bright. And not very bird friendly either. I think it's a bird killer.
Are those buildings held in moderate contempt by most modern architects?
Contempt would be maybe too strong a word.
Condescension?
They kind of ignore them at this point, I think. It's just kind of seen as kind of the dying embers of postmodernism.
But you see, that's where architecture as the art that they force upon you and which you can't get rid of really stands out. Those buildings are there.
They're worse things, though.
Yeah,
on the Chicago skyline.
Oh yeah, sure.
Like what?
Well, I mean, a lot of you know, we talk about this all the time. The condo towers, like One Superior Place, that went up during the late '90s and early 2000s.
That Dearborn Corridor.
Yeah, and the Dearborn Corridor. I mean, these were they all look like they were designed by refugees from East Germany. I mean, these are true monstrosities. True monstrosities. Hulks. Finished Hulks, not Incredible Hulks,
so.
Unfinished Hulks, like we were talking about before.
Well, we'll talk about some other buildings that have risen more recently, about which you have more favorable attitude or more favorable evaluation. When we return to Blair Kamen and John Ronan, after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are talking about the architectural scene in Chicago. And apparently what excites Blair Kamen most these days is a building down on the campus of the University of Chicago.
Well, this is a building. I wouldn't say it's my most exciting thing, but it's one of them, I'll admit. It's the Joe Enrica Mansueto Library, an addition to the Regenstein Library at the University of Chicago. This is a building that was designed by Helmut Jahn. It is it has a domed steel and glass reading room. But that is an extraordinary space for reading, which has wonderful views from the inside out to the Gothic architecture of the University of Chicago. But what truly makes this building unique is what's below the reading room. This is a storage area for thousands upon thousands of books. And all you have to do, Milt, if you want a book, is enter it into a computer. And a robotic arm goes down into these stacks, picks out a tray where your book is, brings it upstairs, and you can get your book within 3 minutes instead of waiting like 2 or 3 days for it to arrive from an offsite location.
You didn't have to wait 2 or 3 days. I've used the library there for many, many, many years.
Oh, no. I mean,
Regenstein, you just go into the stacks and find your book.
I mean, had the books been located offsite, like somewhere out in the suburbs or far away, in the city.
Which has happened at some other university libraries.
And many others, right. And the faculty at the U of C were adamant. They said, keep our books here. Mm-hmm. And they decided to do it. And instead of it just making it to be a monster of a warehouse, they made this building, particularly from the inside looking out, a real enhancement to the campus. The students went crazy over it on the first day. They went inside. They were thrilled. They could see light. They could, it was, you know, they, I mean, I've never seen students so enthusiastic about a library.
There's something that does deface the outside of the building just a little. And it is the names of the donors, which are written in large billboard letters across the whole base. And it looks strangely commercial.
I thought it was too, the names were too big.
Much too big.
Should have been understated more. But that's the world we live in.
Who are those people?
Joe Enrique Mansueto. Joe made his money at Morningstar, the financial information.
Mm-hmm. Mutual funds.
What's that?
They rated mutual funds.
Right, exactly. So I think that's where that money, and he's a university graduate, very generous. And, you know, look, they can change the graphics maybe someday.
But the building, my advice that they do that quickly.
Yeah, well, it would be mine too. The building itself, particularly the reading room, is a real enhancement to the campus.
What else is happening on that campus?
Well, another thing on that campus that's very exciting is the light bridges, what are called the light bridges.
Yes, I've seen them.
Across the Midway. And this is a series of pylons that try to make it easier for U of C students to go from the main campus to what's called the South Campus.
Well, across the Midway.
Across the Midway. Yeah, for many years, as we all know, there's been some crime in that area. It's been a little bit scary for students to cross the Midway. The light bridges consist of a series of light pylons designed by Jamie Carpenter, primarily by Jamie Carpenter, a New York artist. They look like, the students call them the lightsabers because they remind them of the lightsabers that Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker jousted with.
I can see that.
In the Star Wars movie. So they've been named, and I think affectionately named. And they shine beautifully at night. They consist of like a metal mesh in which these lights project beautifully outward. They're inspired in some respects by the bridges that Frederick Law Olmsted had envisioned for the Midway, because the Midway, as you remember, was to be have a water feature that connected Jackson Park on the east with Washington Park on the west. It was never built. But these crossings are bridge-like. They evoke those bridge-like, the bridges of Olmsted that were never built. So wonderful little intervention into the public space of the Midway that's really humanized it and created delight without obstructing the grand vistas.
Campus architecture, of course, interests me a great deal, having been a university type all of my rather long life. And only recently I had occasion to go to UIC for a meeting. And I had been on that campus many times before, but not for the last 3 or 4 years. And there I was going to a meeting and looking around a bit and driving in and out of a parking space. And I won't say what I thought, but I would love to ask John Ronan, when it comes to campi, if that's the proper plural for campuses, which is an affectation in itself, but when it comes to campuses, what do you make of that one? Do you like it? It was totally conceived by Walter Netsch, wasn't it?
Walter Netsch was the architect of that. Yeah. And it won every award you could possibly win when it first opened.
That would have been a good 40 years ago or thereabouts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a lot of just very kind of novel things like raised walkways that you would walk between buildings, amphitheaters where students and faculty could collect. It was very well intentioned.
Pits. There were a few places where you have things dug into the ground where you sit around and on banked space, supposedly to converse.
Yeah, wonderful ideas. I think the reality was they became kind of dangerous spaces, and perhaps it wasn't the school wasn't dense enough to support the kind of activity that was envisioned on these. So I'm sad as an architect to see that those were taken down and. You know, but I understand why that happens, you know.
Are the buildings as they stand there individually of some architectural significance?
Yeah, I think the original ones are that Netsch did, absolutely. The new buildings are, like the dorms and so forth, are unspectacular.
Well, dorms are fine. We've got that orange dorm at the University of Chicago. It was done by some Mexican architect, wasn't it?
Ricardo Legarreta.
What do you make of that building?
I think that building was too much about Ricardo Legarreta.
It surely doesn't fit the general Gothic style of the university.
And you don't have you don't necessarily have to mimic the Gothic style, but Legarreta had a style which was, you know, rooted in his native Mexico, mm-hmm. and which was brightly colored and worked wonderfully there. Mm-hmm. And it just seems, although it works well as a dorm, it just seems bright and a little garish and a little out of place in the U of C. The three entry pavilions are bright yellow, bright pink, and bright purple. The students refer to them as Barney, Big Bird, and Barbie. And I don't think those were necessarily affectionate nicknames. It's a good place to live, I think. It's a good dorm, and it helped, the U of C needed good dorm space. But I do think it was a reflection of the Starcutect era, the Star Architect era, in which buildings tended to be more about the architect than their surroundings.
Well, the great Star Architect apparently has been for some time the fellow who gave us the theater at
Millennium Park, Frank Gehry.
Millennium Park. Frank Gehry, is that his name?
Yes.
Is his vogue passing, or is he still celebrated by one and all?
He's still talked about quite a bit in the press. I mean, he's still kind of a darling of the press.
Is he a darling of the architects?
I think he's respected as somebody who is still trying to push outward. He's not, in other words, he's not just polishing the groove and repeating himself building after building. Each building is a little bit different, a little more challenging. He's one of these architects that is using these new technologies that we talked about a while ago. So, I think you just reviewed one of his buildings in New York, and that's a pretty inventive building, I have to say. So,
yeah, I mean, this is Frank Gehry did a building in New York and a 76-story apartment tower. Such is Frank Gehry's fame that the building is officially being marketed as New York by Gehry, one of the most pretentious building names I have ever heard.
Oh,
it's normally just called 8th Spruce Street, its address. Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating building, Milt. I mean, where do we start? The building curves. It has all these undulations in it, not only in its floor plates horizontally, but also its walls, its facade curve vertically. And it's sheathed in stainless steel, and it looks like someone took tinfoil, crumpled it, and made it into the facade for a building.
Sounds like him.
It sounds, yes.
You know the name John Silber?
Yes, John Silber.
Former president of Boston University.
Yes, John Silber.
John and I were young men together at Yale. We taught a course together many, many years ago. He's a few years older than me. He went on to an interesting career. He wound up president of Boston University, which he ruled with an iron hand. But eventually he had to retire, though he's still sort of officially the honorary president. But they built a Gehry building as a dormitory.
At MIT, not at Boston
at
University.
At MIT,
right
nearby. And it so offended John Silber that he had to write a book against modern architecture, in which the building most centrally featured is that particular one at MIT.
John Silber is a bright guy, and he's totally wrong about architecture. He thinks Frank Gehry is a one-trick pony, and who just keeps on repeating himself. And you know what? Here's my big question. Ask yourself, what good buildings were ever built at Boston University when John Silber was running it? The answer is none.
But apparently the Gehry building is crumbling. It's dysfunctional.
You know, I think the building had some functional problems, and there was a lawsuit over them, and John Silber tried to make great hay out of that, saying Frank Gehry was, you know, an out-of-control egomaniac.
Yeah.
I think Frank Gehry is remarkably attuned to the users of his building. I mean, I went into this building in New York. Frank Gehry designed the interior of this building, the apartments, right down to the door handles. Frank Gehry is a good architect, and he gets away with what he does because he cares about users and those kind of issues.
This is Extension 720 at WGN Radio, 720 in Chicago, and we are overdue for a quick update on the news. We'll go to that and then directly back to John Ronan and Blair Kamen, and in a while on to your calls for your attitudes, your opinions, and for that matter, for your questions about the buildings of Chicago. Some of the great old ones, as well as some of the great new ones, and some of the less than great new ones. Our lines are going to be open shortly, and indeed we'll open them right now. The number, of course, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. Any question you've got, any opinion you want to voice, get in there quickly at 312-591-7200. And now to the WGN Newsroom and Rob Martyr.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are roaming around the skyline of Chicago tonight, talking about architectural issues and about some of the buildings that one admires, some of the buildings that one puzzles over and wonders just why they were put up in the form in which they were put up. And my guests are Blair Kamen, who is the well-known architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune, won a Pulitzer Prize a few years ago for his writing. John Ronan is one of the leading younger architects in town and does have opinions which are much to be welcomed. And we've talked about some of his recent buildings, particularly the Poetry Foundation building. Let us address some other matters. I learned that, John, in fact, you've had a major hand in designing a big special exhibit or show that will be opening at the Art Institute relating to Chicago architecture.
Yeah, it's called Bertrand Goldberg, Architect of Invention, and it opens at the Art Institute of Chicago in the new modern wing on September 17th. And I did the design of the exhibition.
Bertrand Goldberg was a guest more than once, I think, on this program, since the program has been around for a rather long time. And probably Blair Kamen brought him in here one night.
I don't know about that.
At any rate, he was on the program. Of course, he's best known in Chicago for Marina City, is he not?
Right. Marina City is his masterpiece. And this of course, is the two curvilinear towers that look like corn cobs right along the Chicago River. However, the complex is really a city within a city. It's notable on many levels for its structural engineering, its architecture, also as an urban set piece. You have to remember that when this went up in the 1960s, you know, the question was who was going to be the last person in Chicago to turn out the lights. This complex went up. I think it really showed great faith in the city. Really a city within a city. It had a bowling alley. It had an office building. It really kind of helped lead to the revival of the downtown.
Another building of his is the Prentice Women's Hospital, part of the Northwestern Medical Complex, which there's great controversy right now because there is a plan to tear it down.
Yes. Northwestern University wants to tear the building down to build a medical research tower. Historic preservationists in Chicago have been fighting like crazy to try to save this building.
It's also in that same circular design, isn't it?
It's similar to, it's a cousin, one could say, a sibling of Marina City. Somewhat less graceful, but in many ways more powerful structurally. The building has huge cantilevers. It grows out of a box on the bottom, and then it shoots up, and there are these quatrefoil-shaped towers on top of it, of almost cylinders of concrete with porthole-like windows punched into them. There are a lot of people, honestly, who hate this building, who think it's an eyesore. My view is that it's really worth saving, and I think many architects, not only in Chicago but around the world,
agree. I suppose John also is convinced that it's worth saving.
Absolutely should be saved. In fact, I think they should tear down the new one, which is a really banal, poorly designed building. So I think we're going in the wrong direction. We're tearing down architecturally significant buildings and we're putting up kind of vanilla boxes.
But you have to wonder about a building, not only how attractive the design is or how advanced the design is, but whether it's functional, whether it works well. And people say that that building is in some ways dysfunctional.
Well, no, I would say, I've been in both that building and the new building. I had one child born in the old Prentice, Goldberg's building, and one born in the new one. Okay, so I feel like I'm in a position to weigh in on
this.
You are
indeed, yeah.
The Goldberg building is just completely intuitive. You can go there for the first time, never having been there, and completely understand where you're supposed to go. and how you get there. It's brilliantly laid out. I think a testament to this is that the newest hospital in town, being built over in Rush, is almost the exact same parterre. Now, parterre is kind of the organizational diagram. There's kind of a podium with a kind of a wavy, curvilinear building portion of the building rising up from it. Almost the exact same thing. So I think that really undermines the the argument that Prentice couldn't be used. The new building is very dysfunctional. It's a labyrinthine. I went there probably 16 times. I was just as lost the 16th time I went there as the first time I went there. And I'm an architect, so. Mm.
It's a real challenge, though, to reuse the building. I mean, Northwestern has done studies, and it looks like it's going to be very hard to get a medical research facility into the existing Prentice building. The ceilings aren't high enough for the ductwork that modern science buildings require. So that use probably isn't going to work. But there may be other ones. There's an apartment, high-rise apartment boomlet in Chicago right now. There's a demand for apartments. Prentice could... one possible use that Landmarks Illinois, the preservation group, has explored for that with architects is as a possible apartment tower. What ultimately it's going to come down to is whether the city of Chicago and Rahm Emanuel want to try to save this building and create a zoning trade-off that will enable Northwestern to recoup some of the lost square footage that they would give up for saving Prentice and use somewhere else. I mean, ultimately, when you boil it down, this is in many the politics of this has to do with a zoning dispute,
yeah.
But it's more than that. As John has said, it's us recognizing that this is one of the great sculptural works of architecture from its era in the 1970s.
Two other locations where some updating or refurbishing is planned, but it's not too clear yet just what is going to be done at both of those locations are one. The old post office, and two, Navy Pier. What do we know about that?
Well, I'll let Blair talk about Navy Pier. I have some history with the post office. I did a scheme about 7 years ago to turn that building into a mausoleum, a municipal mausoleum. So I know the it's been sitting kind of dormant for ever since they built the new post office.
What do you mean to turn it into a municipal mausoleum?
It would be the building is very it's another incredible Hulk, right? So it's the size of a football field inside. It's a very robust building, and this is because Chicago used to be the catalog capital of the country. So all the
Sears
catalogs from Sears, Ward's came out of this.
I see.
So it's a very robust structure that has really resisted. It's not easy to convert it to residential, let's say, and it has windows on the exterior, but very, very deep floor plates. So it's resisted for this reason all kinds of attempts to reconfigure it. And I think the new plan is by a British shopping mall developer to convert it into kind of a retail space along with some additional towers as if it wasn't big enough kind of across the river on adjacent parcels.
Is that a good idea?
You know, I think it's a great question. What do we do with these buildings? It's a sustainability issue, right? Because every city has these old buildings and we can't just keep tearing things down. We have to reuse them. My feeling, I don't know the scheme very well. Blair, I'm sure, knows it better than I do. But I think they could find a use that keeps more of the existing building.
It's they're putting a big box like an IKEA in this building may not be a bad idea. But the scheme, the initial plan that was unveiled was absolutely over the top. I mean, it had a 2,000-foot residential tower or mixed-use tower. It had six towers, some of which were residential, some of which were hotel. I mean, this was like a fantasy. In this economy, who needs, all these tall buildings? In terms of it would have preserved the old post office, which is actually a handsome building by Graham Anderson Probst and White, the successor firm to Daniel Burnham, an art modern building of some grace, even though it's very big. But it would have preserved it, also would have encased it in this giant shopping mall. So it would have kind of saved it on the one hand and entombed it on the other. The worst part of the plan was that there would have been, it depended on having the shopping mall cross the Chicago River. So in other words, the shopping mall would have been inside the old post office. There would have been parking in the old post office and also parking on the east side of the Chicago River. So you would have had a six-story high pedestrian bridge crossing the Chicago River. Now, if there's ever a view-blocking monstrosity that we should want to not happen, that's it.
Now, in just a minute or two, because we've got to stop for some commercials and then sure. on to the phones, the lines are open, 312-591-7200. Get your calls in. We'll be with you shortly. But in a minute or two, what's going on over at Navy Pier?
Well, Navy Pier, there's actually some excitement and reason for optimism. Just last week, the people who run Navy Pier announced that they were embarking upon an international search for teams of architects and other designers, landscape architects, artists, engineers, etc., to refashion the pier's public spaces. This is everything from the park on the west side of the pier mm-hmm. to the east end public space that looks out over Lake Michigan. So this is exciting because only 5 years ago, the pier was thinking about turning itself into a ridiculous-looking theme park with roller coasters. And
well, I think it's a pretty ridiculous-looking theme park right now.
Well, Milt, it would have been even more ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, this would have taken the ridiculous quotient to new heights. Uh-huh. So they're trying to make it into something that has the aesthetic aspirations of Millennium Park. That's both a social success and an aesthetic success. And I think it's great that they're you know, trying to reach, set their sights a little higher than they had before.
Now then, we are about to pause for the usual reasons and then on to the phones. The number, 312-591-7200. Anything you want to ask, anything you want to assert, anything you want to whine about, anything you want to celebrate, all relating to the buildings and the public spaces, about which we haven't talked enough directly, but that's part of the total architectural scene. The buildings and the public spaces of Chicago. And if you're listening at some great distance and listening over the internet and want to get to us, the other available modality, of course, is email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com. If you're in Vancouver, or if you're in Sydney, Australia, or if you're in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia and you want to tell us about architectural developments there as compared to the stuff we've been talking about here, we'd be delighted to hear from you via email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And for calls, again, 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Architecture is the issue, architecture in Chicago, and we are talking with Blair Kamen and John Ronan, and we'll go directly to your calls to them on 312-591-7200. And first up is Russell. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milt, and hello to your guests. I was wondering about politics and architecture, specifically like, you know, how Italy under Mussolini had a certain architectural style, and now here in America we're in this era of privatization with the universities being more kind of, you might say, closed off from the general citizenry, and even like hotels, they have the lobby on like the second or third floor. There seems to be sort of a turning our backs away from the public. And I was just wondering if the architects have any opinions on that. I know in Boston there was a hotel called the Lafayette Plaza, and everything was built to cater to the guests but not to really welcome the public, the pedestrian public. Any opinions on that?
Let us find out. Gentlemen.
Well, I think you're talking about the segregation of public space. And this is something that we see in our stadiums, right, where there are skyboxes and then there are separate entrances for the people in skyboxes. And so we see a kind of breakdown of the democratic mixing chambers of public space that you're talking about. I think there's a truth to that, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's an overriding truth. Think of Millennium Park. That public space has been enormously successful in attracting people from all walks of life. And it's now, you know, 7 years old and going strong. So I think that there's reason, some reason for hope, at least, against the kind of segregation of public space and separation of people into different, you know, social classes and groups that you're talking about.
It's interesting he makes reference to architecture in Mussolini's Italy. It was supposedly inspired by Roman design, but also it had a gargantuan qualities, and Hitler picked up on that.
Yeah.
And he had a plan for Berlin, which, designed by, what's his name?
Albert Speer.
By Speer, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you remember that central building in that vast new Berlin that he was hoping to build after he had won the war?
Yeah, I don't remember
the largest dome in the world.
Well, Chicago could have had something very, very much like that if Daniel Burnham's plan for a city hall had been built here. I mean, everyone always talks about how great the Burnham plan was, and it was, but it also had some pretty terrible parts, and that was one of them. So fortunately, we didn't get stuck with that
one. Never heard about that. What was it like?
Oh, well, that was the Burnham had this symbolic centerpiece, which was a skyscraper-like dome. It would have been 20 stories, 25 stories high. Right at, would have been right now at Congress and Halsted.
Yeah,
right?
What we got instead was the Chicago Circle Interchange.
Right, the spaghetti bowl. Uh-huh. So not so city beautiful. But so anyway.
The problem with Burnham's plan was it came out in 1909, just as the first Model Ts were rolling off the assembly line in Detroit. So that's why we ended up with the Interchange instead of the Grand Domed Palace.
Wasn't there a sort of architectural tone or style in the New Deal, way back?
Absolutely.
How would you describe that?
It was Art Moderne.
Art Moderne.
Simple, but monumental.
Neoclassical, sort of.
With classical influence.
It had columns.
Yeah, it had columns, but they were flattened.
Uh-huh.
They had eagles, but they too were flattened.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as kind of voluptuous and sculptural as the turn of the century Beaux-Arts classicism. But it managed really to be modern and to have classical authority.
What are some of the better buildings it left behind?
Well, one in Chicago was the Field Building, which is the LaSalle, which many people have called the LaSalle Bank Building on LaSalle Street. It has this absolutely wonderful atrium passageway that goes from LaSalle to, what is it, Clark. And it's often said that in that passageway, I mean, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers could dance away the night. You know, it's kind of has this wonderful black tie elegance. There are beautiful bridges that cross the space. They have clocks on them that look like, you know, beautiful square Longines watches on an elegant woman's wrist. Just an absolutely marvelous space.
I'm not sure I've ever been in there.
You got to go.
Where do I go to walk through it?
Well, there's an entrance right off LaSalle Street. And LaSalle, and it's right near the Rookery, so that puts it at
Madison?
No, a little bit further south.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Milt, I'll give Monroe? You the exact address afterwards. I can't remember.
Well, it's now south. The LaSalle Bank, is it?
I think it's LaSalle Bank or Bank of America. Banks change so often that I can't remember which bank owns it.
That sounds
wonderful. But all those post offices and many other public buildings of that era were beloved for good reason.
Yeah. And for equally good reason, we pause right now for an update on the news. Then right back to the phones. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. We've got some lines available. And if you hit the busy signal, of course, the proper strategy is to try once again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. 312-591-7200. If you want to reach us by email, that is extension 720 at wgnradio.com. And with that, to the WGN Newsroom and Rob Martier.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we go to Miles, who's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma, I gather. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yes, I moved to Chicago approximately 4 years ago, and I'm still exploring the city, architecture. And I really love it. There's just so many different designs everywhere I go. And I've taken a particular interest in the skyscrapers. And there's so many different ones to see that I love. I love the Aqua Building, for one. I believe Roosevelt Place, right there by Lake Shore, is a beautiful building. But I'm calling to ask about the Chicago Spire. Have they abandoned that project? Are they going to resume?
No, we talked about that earlier tonight. They have totally abandoned it,
yeah,
apparently.
Dead as a doornail.
No spire. Right. You're going to have to settle for a shorter skyscraper. What's the tallest building in town at the moment?
Still Willis Tower.
Is that a Sears Tower?
Correct.
Those name changes never take, do they?
Well, we're just going to have to get used to them.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter.
And it's not going to be the tallest building in the United States much longer. The One World Trade Center in New York City is going to top it as the tallest building in the United States. Yeah. And frankly, I mean, Chicago architects now designing super tall buildings, they're designing them overseas. Adrian Smith recently designed the Burj Khalifa, which is half a mile high.
That is the tallest building in the world.
Building in the world. And he, this summer, unveiled a design for another tower, which will be in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, which will be called the Kingdom Tower. That will be a kilometer high, 3,200 feet. Wow.
Well, you remember the old song about the Depression, once I built a tower, reached the sky, and so on.
Yeah.
What's the point in always ascending? Is it just a competition to see who will go the highest?
Of course.
I think it's, well, I think for many years, modernism was always kind of defined itself as a sort of exceeding technical boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of one of the most prominent boundaries to exceed.
I suppose it would be, yeah.
But this is now a game where emerging countries want to put themselves on the map. And what better way to do it than with the world's tallest building?
Years ago, Frank Lloyd Wright, I do remember. I wasn't in Chicago at the time, but I remember he announced a 2-mile-high building that he had designed.
The Illinois Mile High, it was called.
Oh, only 1 mile
high. Well, only a mile high. But, you know, I mean, Milt, that's a tall building. That's a tall building.
But that was sort of a joke on his part, was it?
Well, it was, Wright was probably serious. He just was, he couldn't find the right client to build build a building that tall, yeah.
Let me read you an email I've got here about the French-born but Chicago-based architect Lucien Lagrange. He has done more buildings in Chicago than any other architect. I think he is underappreciated. Has he really done more buildings than any other architect?
I don't know the numbers. I would doubt that, but he's certainly done quite a few in the past 20 years or so.
And his towers include the Park Tower, which is just west of the Water Tower, the Elysian, which is a hotel and condominium tower. He's got two other very prominent projects going up right now, one in North Michigan Avenue, the other on the old Columbus Hospital site in Lincoln Park.
Is he underappreciated?
Well, he may be by me.
You don't appreciate him very
well. Well, you know what, Lucien? Let's be fair. I mean, Lucien design. There is a segment of the market that wants to live in traditionally styled buildings. There always has been. There probably always will be, and that's good for the city of Chicago to give people choices. Not everybody is a modernist. Not everybody wants to live in a steel and glass high rise. I have not been a fan of some of Lucien's designs, like the Elysian, for example. Instead of limestone, it gives us exposed concrete. Mm-hmm. Instead of a real mansard roof, it gives us a mansard roof that looks like a Shriner's fez, and is frankly one of the more awkward tops to appear on the Chicago skyline in recent years. So I don't think that's his best building. He is a talented architect. He's done some modern work as well as classical work, but some of the traditional work just doesn't rise to the level of the buildings that they evoke from the 1920s and the turn of the century.
Here's a question that takes us elsewhere. At World Trade Center space, which will open on the 11th, a lot of changes over the years. How does an architect keep up with changes and the pressure?
Well, an architect has to bend without trying to break and lose the integrity of his design. I mean, I'm sure, John, that this is something that something you've had to deal with, and mm-hmm. say, like in working with the Chicago Public Schools and in some of your work. In New York, the architect Michael Arad, who the questioner is asking about, had to give up certain aspects of his memorial for the September 11th memorial. There were ramps that would have led down to reflecting pools that would have been surrounded by the names of the victims. That was eliminated because of cost and security concerns. And now the bronze panels reflecting with the names of the victims are at ground level, surrounding the reflecting pools. But the essence of the scheme, these two deeply recessed reflecting pools that are built within the footprints of the Twin Towers, that's still there. And so I think, you know, architects sometimes have to give a little bit as long as they retain the essence of their scheme.
Here's another one by email that refers to a building I'm not sure I know. Reading, what is the opinion of the new Rush Hospital spaceship, which now dominates the west side? It is starting to grow on me, but it still scares me. And this man, John, identifies himself as an architect.
We actually referred to this building earlier in the show when we were talking about Goldberg's Prentice building. So it's I think it's a very nice building. It's a great addition to Chicago.
Is it fair to call it a spaceship? What is its shape?
It's sort of a three-lobed kind of almost Lake Point Tower-ish shaped white kind of hospital bed volume on top of sort of a more of a squarish blocky podium, not unlike Goldberg's Prentice building, which had a curvilinear building surmounting a blocky podium.
I think the key is that there are good spaceships and there are bad spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes spaceship connotes alien. But spaceship can also be exciting. I mean, think of some of the old sci-fi movies, which we had wonder in dealing with spaceships. So, look, Helmut Jahn's State of Illinois building, the Thompson Center, is probably not the best spaceship because of its very garish exterior, really not working within the confines of the loop. But there are other spaceship-like buildings.
What about this particular one? And who designed this one, by the way?
This is by Ralph Johnson of Perkins & Will, one of the city's top architects. Mm-hmm. I am very excited about this building. I mean, I have not been inside, so I have no idea whether form and function work in tandem. But purely driving by as a work of architectural sculpture, it's an eye-grabber. And I don't think it's just an eye-grabber for the sake of being an eye-grabber. I think it could be one of the year's top buildings,
really?
But we have to see how it works.
Yeah, and I would add to that it's great to see really well-designed hospital. I mean, these are some of the most banal building types that you see that just kind of disappear. So, it's great that the caller, I think, is actually noticing these buildings. It's about time we had some of the best designers working on this building type.
And here's our next caller. Andrew is with us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. Love the show. Love the topic. My question is about Frank Lloyd Wright, whom you just spoke of about a minute ago, I believe. I'm a big fan of his. I even traveled out to Taliesin out in Arizona once. I love his philosophy on architecture and everything. Maybe your guests can speak on that. But my question or comment, and I'll hang up and listen, a lot of criticisms that I've heard of him or read is that a lot of his designs were maybe not built to last, and I'm speaking structurally. Maybe your guests could speak on that, and thank you very much.
Stay with us. Don't go. Don't hang
up. Okay.
You may want to respond further.
Wright said, "Great buildings all leak." And I think...
Did he say that?
Did he say that? Or was that just an excuse after the fact for his own buildings?
There's a great story where one of his clients called him very angrily one night and said, Frank, I'm sitting here eating my dinner with my family at the dinner table, and there's water dripping on my head. And Wright's response was, well, move your chair. So the thing, Wright was very innovative in how he made his buildings. You said you went out to Taliesin. I mean, that was built with a concrete made from the earth on site and rocks from on site. He would do very kind of daring things, and sometimes they were just very groundbreaking. Other times he got himself in trouble.
He pushed the limits. There's no doubt about it. At his most famous house, Falling Water, the cantilevering roof terraces a few years ago started sagging. There was real concern that they would fall into the stream below them, so they had to be shored up. They're right clearly exceeded the engineering of the time. I mean, he was the engineers just couldn't catch up with him.
I also heard there's a great mildew problem with that house as well.
I haven't heard about that.
From it being over the waterfall. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. That's that. Well, the next time I'm there, I'll check that out. Unity Temple, his other one of his other masterworks in Oak Park, has had functional problems as well, and has been a real headache in some respects for its congregation to try to keep it up in tip top shape.
But we should also, to be fair, talk about the real success stories too. The Johnson Wax Building in Racine, Wisconsin, was a huge success story, where the structure of the building was based on sort of dendriform columns that he looked at sort of botany textbooks and based them on plant structure. And all these officials, the code officials, and engineers said, "Oh, this will never work." And he loaded this up with sandbags on site, and it exceeded the allowable load by a factor of five, I think, before it finally collapsed. So that was a real success.
And of course, he was supremely influential, was he not? In some ways, he's the most influential architect of the last century, I should say.
Well, I would say that an argument can be made that Mies van der Rohe was actually, Wright may have been the most celebrated architect, but his work is often characterized as idiosyncratic, whereas Mies van der Rohe is often, I think, rather is characterized as Mies set the rules. And in other words, he set the rules for international style modernism. So that went all over the world. And then he was even influential in terms of the reaction against international style modernism, because the postmodernists were reacting against Mies. Mies, less is a bore, as Robert Venturi once said, which he later took back.
But his response to the famous Miesian axiom,
less is more.
Less is more.
Correct. Yeah. So I'd say that Wright is celebrated and beloved by the public for every good reason. I mean, he's a genius, and he's probably the greatest American architect ever. But in terms of influence, Mies may top him.
Yeah. Our thanks to the caller. We stop for a moment for a last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones. Some lines are available now if you've been trying to reach us. 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to John Ronan and Blair Kamen. Here's an interesting contribution via email. This fellow, Stewart in Highland Park, says, Union Station is at overcapacity due to the expansion of Amtrak and Metro Commuter Service. Why not turn the base of the old post office into a modern and majestic train station to rival Grand Central in New York City?
Well, he's right. There are train tracks underneath that building. That building was served by trucks, train, and also by water. So
I suppose it
could be done.
I think it could be done, but I think the location of the post office is its problem, because it's just too far away for commuters from the Loop. You know, it's another block or so. There is talk about trying to create a multinodal transportation center there. In other words, something that could incorporate the Blue Line, long-distance high-speed rail, perhaps some other forms of transit. So I don't think it's a totally off-the-wall question, but I don't see Union Station just, you know, moving to the south. I don't think that's going to happen.
What are the great architectural desecrations in this country? We had occasion somehow to talk about it not too long ago.
Pennsylvania Station was certainly one. And Chicago.
That's the one I have in mind.
And you know what? There was Pennsylvania Station, just for the listeners who don't know it, was a great McKim, Mead & White building.
Yeah.
A train station in New York based on the Baths of Caracalla, the great Roman.
A gorgeous inner space.
Great Roman baths. And it was torn down by the Penn Central Railroad. And it really sparked the creation of the historic preservation movement, the modern historic preservation movement. But, you know, there was actually an equivalent in Chicago. There was a building just to the east of Union Station, which was a train shed. Fabulous space, steel framed, wonderful, soaring space. And it was torn down in the 60s to make room for two utterly banal modern office towers. And now the entry space for Union Station is jammed into the basement of those buildings. That's why that Union Station feels so constricted. It's one of those things that is, you talk about eyesores and things that affect thousands of people every day. That is one of the hugest mistakes Chicago has ever made in terms of its transportation infrastructure.
Well, it seems to me the history of architecture in relation to cities and in relation to real estate people is as much filled with disaster as it is filled with high achievement.
That's true. We make huge mistakes all the time. And the, you know, I mean, my job writing as a critic is to try to be like an early warning system,
and you
radar.
And you do that particularly well. We go back to the phones on 312-591-7200. Scott is next. Good evening.
Great show, gentlemen. With 9/11 approaching, it's important to note that the original World Trade Center architect, Yamasaki, has two important connections to the city of Chicago, one being the old Montgomery and Ward's office building. The other, I think more significantly, is the North Shore Congregation Israel Synagogue, which was built a couple of years before the World Trade Center and has many of the elements that he incorporated into those buildings.
That's the one on Sheridan Road?
Yes.
Yeah, it's on Sheridan Road in Highland Park. I've been in that. I've been in that sanctuary. It is an awe-inspiring space, absolutely enormous, and really only meant to be used, I would say. I mean, only fit in certain respects for the you know, the Jewish New Year when thousands of people come in. The congregation actually had to build an addition, a chapel that Thomas Beebe designed as a cylindrical space, because the Yamasaki space, as marvelous as it is, just wasn't intimate enough for ordinary worship. But an utterly significant space, as the caller says, and absolutely worth noting with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 coming up.
Well, we thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. Let's go quickly to another, time being rather short. And next up is Eric. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hi, Mel. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered what you and your guest thought about the James R. Thompson Center State of Illinois building. I know you spoke about it a little bit. And if you didn't want to talk about that, also want to talk about the Harold Washington Library, one of my favorite buildings of the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the somebody emailing us earlier talked about being rather frightened by one of the buildings, that the spaceship he spoke of at Rush Presbyterian. I'm still frightened by the that the other spaceship.
The interior of the Thompson Center.
The interior of the Thompson Center, yeah. It is absolutely vertiginous.
Yeah, I think the Thompson Center was built at a time. It was a very daring structure when you had architects that were not doing daring things. And I think Helmut unfortunately paid the price for that for a while, and that he didn't build much in Chicago after that. But I think it's a very significant piece of architecture, and I think it's a great public space, and it's great to this day. You know, it had problems with heating and cooling and so forth, but I think it will be remembered and landmarked for sure one day.
The Harold Washington Library?
I'd say a disappointment. I'd love to know why the caller loves it.
Let's ask him. Why do you love it, sir?
I just thought that the way the architecture at the end of State Street and Congress there, I'd like the shape of it. I like the color scheme, and I like some of the ornamental effects of it.
But what about that glass wall on the west face? That's ludicrous.
I respect as a work of urban design what this building did in some ways, because it's solid, it's muscular, like the great retail palaces of State Street. It fills out the block, it shapes the street. I think, though, in some ways the building was backward looking, and you know, the ornament is a bit cartoonish up on the top, those giant owls that look like they're going to swoop down.
Well, it's an imitation of Parisian Beaux-Arts design, is it not?
Or actually, I'd say Tom Beebe was trying to incorporate many aspects of Chicago classicism, from the Rookery to Daniel Burnham's Beaux-Arts classicism. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's that glass wall, which kind of winks at you and says, it's postmodern, and says, well, we're not really, you know, this is... we're not really totally serious about wrapping this building and with classes. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the owls are I think still frighten me to this day. And, I know people used to put owls on buildings to scare away pigeons, but yeah. I think those are scaled to scare away airplanes, I think.
Gentlemen, we are out of time. Our thanks to the caller, and warm thanks to Blair Kamen and John Ronan for joining us tonight. Been a memorable program, as the topic of architecture always does bring out interesting detail and always fascinates the listeners and the host of the program. And the host of the program wants to tell you that we'll be here, of course, tomorrow night for a full two-hour program starting at 10 o'clock with two people who've been involved in a major study about American youth and what ails them. Not what ails them physically, what ails them characterologically. We'll talk more about that tomorrow with these two visitors from Notre Dame, where this major project has recently been completed. And until then, as we wind down, I remind you to check our website and check particularly for all the podcasts available there. Just go to wgnradio.com/extension720. Until tomorrow at 10, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.